This week on Out of the Air, our whole show features Jason DeClaire Taylor, who creates underwater sculptures and installations that help restore equilibrium to deteriorating marine ecosystems, creating whole undersea museums throughout the world. Our spotlights on the 39th Annual Interwoven Expressions, a juried art market of all things created by Midwest textile artists, coming November 9th to Sand Creek Country Club.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight, Lou T-Rock. She's the president of the Interwoven Expressions, and she's got an event coming up. They're a juried market for all things created by the Midwest tile artists, weavers, felters, spinners, and such. Lou, thank you for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Yeah. Interwoven Expressions is a fantastic event. It features textile artists from just from states that border our Lake Michigan. We have artists coming from Kalamazoo, from Grand Rapids, Chicago, Lafayette, and a lot of Northwest Indiana. There are 22 artists this year. We have weavers, spinners, dyers, felters, silk ribbon embroidery, macrame artists, anything that you can do with fiber. It doesn't matter your technique. It's that everything that you create is done with fiber. This is a collection of incredible, technically proficient textile artists. Some are teachers. Some have their own businesses. Some have even been published. When you walk into Interwoven, it's such an incredible explosion of color. Many people will take an entire walk around the ballroom at Sand Creek Country Club just to see what's available and to get accustomed to all the color that is there. Then they'll start shopping. We have customers who wait in line to get in. They come back year after year. This is our 39th year. Next year will be our 40th celebration.
That's amazing. So how many are returning artists and how many are new artists? What kind of...
This year we have three new artists. The rest are all returning artists. The arrangement is, once you're juried in, and this is a juried show, we have several people who apply, but only the best are added. Once you're juried in, you're there until you decide to drop out. Some years, we cannot even open jurying because no one drops out. We can only have a limited number of artists because the ballroom is only so big. We will have everything from hand-woven jackets, $400 jackets to $4 Christmas ornaments. People plan their Christmas shopping to start at Interwoven Expressions.
How did it begin? Who started it? And was it a weavers collective?
It began as the annual show of the Doonland Weavers Guild. After a few years, we realized that Interwoven is a for-profit event, which jeopardized the not-for-profit standing of the Doolin Weavers Guild, so we separated. And once we separated, it then morphed into an even bigger event because it opened up beyond weavers to anything that is done with fiber. Everything that is at this show incorporates fiber in some way. We have had handmade paper artists in years past. Paper is fiber. We have basket makers. Reed is fiber. Weavers, it's anything that you can do with fiber.
So briefly tell us a little bit about your fiber journey and what you work in, and because obviously you're involved in this group, and tell us a little bit about your background quickly.
My mother put a crochet hook in my hand when I was five. Does that explain it? And I've gone, anything that you can do with fiber, I've probably done. I am a longtime hand spinner. I collect great wheels. I have a collection of very rare great wheels. And I am also a weaver. I have two very large weaving looms in my studio. So it's an affliction, but it's a happy affliction.
That's great. Any chance of, well, you said you have a limited number of people because of where you're having it now, expanding to a larger facility and maybe having more people at your exhibit in the future?
That's what we have done over the years. We started at Mark T. Nielsen Interiors, just off south of Route 6. Then we moved to Aberdeen because Mark T. Nielsen's was too small. Yeah. And then Aberdeen is too small, so now we are at Sand Creek. I can't imagine a larger facility than the Sand Creek Ballroom.
Well, of course, there's the Expo Center in Valparaiso. I mean, I guess if you really got big, that could be a possibility and maybe become a national
event. A weekend show.
that would be a possibility. Right now, we are doing in 8 hours. We will have over 500 people come through. We will do more than $35,000 worth of business in 8 hours. So it's doing well. And I've offered to make changes to the show. And everybody comes, customers and the artists themselves say, don't change a thing. This is great.
Well, we're in our final minute here. We want Lou to give you a chance to tell us how people can find out about the show, either as a participant. Obviously, this year you have all the people that are already preset, but maybe if someone's interested in being part of it as an exhibitor in the 40s show, tell us about that process real quick in our last moments here.
We have a website, and if you'll just go to interwovenexpressions.com, there are jurying instructions there on the website. There is also a prospectus which details how the show is structured so that you have a good idea of what it is before you even apply. Jury applications are accepted in May so that we know who the artist will be. We have a Facebook page, and it's under Interwoven Expressions, Unexpected Fibers. That is the official name of the organization. So, but our website has everything that you want as far as how to attend it, how to apply to participate in it. Everything is at our brand new website.
We appreciate it. That's Lou T. Rock from Interwoven Expressions. Show is November 9th at the Sand Creek Country Club. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thank you. I hope you attend.
Oh, most definitely.
And a Spotlight Extra. The Area Artists Association exhibit It's All About the Square will run through November at Chesterton Art Center with a reception Saturday, November 9th, 12 to 2 p.m. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode.
Hi, this is Rob Quick, author of Finding Your Voice with Radio, Audio, and Podcast Production, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Jason Dakaris Taylor to Art on the Air. Jason is a sculptor, environmentalist, and professional underwater photographer. He became the first of a new generation of artists to shift from land art to the realm of the marine environment. His permanent site-specific sculpted works are predominantly exhibited underwater. They explore themes of conservation and environmental activism. He is best known for his numerous large-scale underwater museums and sculpture parks, creating in 2006 the world's first underwater sculpture park off the west coast of Grenada, and National Geographic has claimed it as one of the 25 wonders of the world. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Jason. It's so nice to meet you.
Yes, likewise. Pleasure.
Thank you, Jason, for joining us. Well, we always like to start off our show with your origin story. I always like to tee it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Jason.
Sure. I mean, it's something that I do reflect on a lot because I remember when I was young, you know, always being sort of nagged by this question, what am I going to do when I'm older? Where am I going to be? What am I going to do? And I'll be honest, I sort of drifted for many years. You know, I didn't have a clue what I was going to do. And it felt an intense pressure that I should know, you know, where I was heading. And I ended up doing lots of sort of different jobs. I was fortunate. I grew up in Malaysia when I was young. So my parents were teachers and they used to drag us around different parts of the world. And we ended up in Malaysia. So I spent a lot of time snorkeling and diving in Thailand and just exploring.
Tide pools.
Yes. Yeah. Amazing place. And then later on, I moved back to the UK and I went to school there. I then ended up going to art college after leaving school. And then when I came out of art college, I felt really confused because it was like, God, you know, how on earth does anyone make a living from this? How am I going to pay my rent and all the rest of it? So I ended up, like many people did, and getting sort of lots of different jobs from restaurants to photography to logistics for events and shows and stage design. And so I did all of these things without any kind of orientation. And then later on in life, you know, it was about 2006, and all my plans had fallen flat on their face in the way I was planning on trying to create a business and then in my spare time work on art as a kind of hobby or something that I could do without the pressures of making a living from it.
So what kind of business were you trying to start?
Scuba diving. So I was looking at running a scuba diving center. And so I actually traveled to Grenada and thought I'd set up a scuba diving center there. And I sold my house and put in almost, you know, 2 or 3 years of research and training and all the rest. And then I sort of finally got to the moment where I had to sort of bite the bullet. And I was like, oh, I really actually hate doing this. The thought of working with the public on a daily basis was just, you know, I just didn't want to do it. And I kind of felt really flat about it and thought, you know, this is it. Everything I've been working to has been lost, you know. But you know what? I'm just going to do something that maybe, you know, is fun and take a year out and just do something interesting. And so that's when I sort of thought about doing underwater art. And I realized I could use some of the skills I learned at art college to actually, as a form of sort of conservation in a marine environment. So I could create works that, you know, promoted life, but also draw tourists away from fragile areas. And I was very fortunate. I was allowed to do it there.
I'm so bubbling with questions, but I do want to go back to childhood and talk about, did you have art in those early, like, what were your leanings? What was home life like? You know, were your parents creative? Because, I mean, I can understand not knowing what you want to do. I still feel like I'm at that point, you know, like maybe I'm just starting to understand what I'm, you know, meant to do, I guess. But so can you really take us back to those early early days? What were you interested in? Because you did mention like set design. So I'm assuming that's with theater, or is it?
Yes, it was theaters. Yeah, shows.
Was that in grade school, or I mean, or you know, in schooling?
As you know, I was after I graduated university. So it was after that time. But I do come from quite an artistic family where lots of my relatives have gone to art college, and it was the subject that I did well at school in, and I had a very, very fortunate to have an amazing teacher when I was young. It was very motivating, and so I kind of, yeah, always knew that I'd go into arts in some way. But then I was also quite a sort of pragmatic person as well, and kind of needed something clearly defined.
So were you skilled in all medium, or did you gravitate towards sculpture even in the early days? Like, you're talking about creative relatives, what kind of mediums were they working in? Because I think all that, you know, we absorb all that information, even if we're not actually producing. But did you have a propensity for a particular medium?
I did a lot of carving. So when I was young, I did some work for like stonemasonry, carving wood. I just sort of love materials. I think like every sculptor does, you know. It's funny, I try and do paintings now in the studio, and I put on so much paint and the layers just keep adding on. And in the end, I'm just like, I'm just making textures and sculpting really, but it, on a flat surface. It's definitely what I'm drawn to.
Yeah, me as well. More of the sculptural, textural materials.
Well, I'm curious about the stage design, being a theater guy myself. So what types of productions you do? Was it, you know, musicals, straight plays? You know, what stage design did you participate in?
So I was in London, just working on sort of small fringe theaters. Building some of the scenery and props. I also did some work on the show. There's a big show in the Millennium Dome in the UK, which is a big sort of huge arena with a kind of Cirque du Soleil show. And I got involved in all the sort of technical side of the acrobatics and the aerial performing. So, yeah, that was quite an interesting time.
Oh, that's a great learning experience, because you learn how everything gets put into place, because so many things are so heavy or cumbersome that you have to, it's not just your body that's lifting things.
Definitely. I mean, now, you know, there's, yeah, I can quite easily do the underwater works. You know, there's I draw on all of these different things. So, you know, I certainly, obviously there's the creative side of it, but there's the logistical side of it. You know, some of the structures are 150 tons. They require huge lifting capacities, and just working at sea is doubly hard, because the crane is bobbing up and down on water, and
the water's temperamental.
The weather's very difficult. There's no stable platform. The sediment moves, so it's kind of even more extreme version of it. But yeah. Definitely draw many of those skills.
So tell us about the transition to start placing your, you know, you obviously already talked about this maybe doing a scuba business, but taking your art and deciding we're going to place it in water. And how, you know, what process did you think, okay, I'm going to put this in? What inspired you, first of all, to do that? And then the process by which you do that?
So, I mean, at the same time when I was at art college, I learned to be a scuba diver. Again, just sort of recreationally. When I graduated, another job I did was I moved to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia and worked on some of the liverboard boats there, teaching scuba diving. And also learned to be an underwater naturalist. And again, I had a very good mentor that was out there that sort of really sort of explained all the sort of ecological processes that happened underwater. And also, more importantly, he was very, very focused on all the threats, you know, 20 years ago, or more, I should say, it was probably about 30 years ago. You know, he was very hyper-focused on all of the pollution, agricultural pollution that was destroying the Great Barrier Reef, and the changes in temperatures were being noted. And so I sort of always came at it from that angle. But I was also because I did so many dives in very similar places, I really sort of started to, you know, go back to the same reef and see how, you know, a fire coral would encrust the surface and give it a certain texture. I would see how, you know, man-made objects would sort of evolve over time, and how light patterns worked, how sands shifted, how creatures inhabited, you know, different spaces.
That's the fascination of it, though. I was fascinated since childhood with sunken ships and how they became like home and shelter for so many. And so that's why, you know, when I learned of your work, I think almost 20 years ago, it's just been so fascinating. So you did go into it knowing that the things that you were going to place were, you know, that you were creating like this artificial reef environment. Because in your dives, were you seeing reefs? Because I've seen reefs that are, you know, dying because of the environmental impact on them. And so to be creating artificial reefs, you know, it's just phenomenal. And then to have it be so beautiful and deliberately placed. I mean, wow, thank you. It's gorgeous.
It was definitely timing and circumstance. You know, when I was in Grenada and I had that sort of time to reflect on things, it was also after a huge hurricane had passed by, and that had really decimated one of the bays with it on the island, and raised the coral to the ground. And so it was.
What time period was that?
That was about 2005. And then Hurricane Ivan, and it passed by, and really was really devastating. And this particular, and what it meant that only a couple of the reefs were in pristine condition. So all of the dive tours and snorkel tours are all heading to that one location. And so, you know, I thought if I could make a diversion and utilize this bay, which had been damaged, which was also very beautiful in its own right, because it had these sort of corridors in the reef and it had these channels and almost like rooms that opened up within the sort of rock faces. I instantly, you know, started to look at pieces that, you know, that would fit within each area.
Was there an inspiration for learning how to dive as a kid? I know I watched a program here in the States called Sea Hunt, and I always wanted to scuba dive as a result of that, and I never really pursued it. But was there any other, or like a Jacques Cousteau thing, was there some other thing that inspired you to say, gee, I really want to do that?
I can't think of anything really. I just knew I was going to do it. It wasn't a case of, you know, if. It was just like, when am I going to, you know, it was like getting a driving license. I knew
sure.
I had to get a diving license. But from a very young age, I've always just been driven by sort of exploring things, and whether that be sort of abandoned buildings or warehouses or air raid shelters or anything, you know, I just always loved sort of looking, go places where, you know, other people hadn't been, or obviously not in abandoned places. But there's so much to explore underwater. It was, yeah. Inevitable.
So it was, so kind of with 2005 being Hurricane Ivan and 2006, you know, the first big works, I guess, in the water. So is that like when you were diving after Ivan, was that when something, putting something artificial or unnatural into something natural to transform it, is that when you decided that balance would be quite satisfying? Or
yes, yeah. I mean, when I was studying art college, my work was always based outside of the gallery, so I was very interested in landscape installations and putting works in urban settings and forests and just looking how as the context of the work, the location of the work changed, and the context, how your relationship to the piece itself and how the pieces could take on the sort of patina or the characteristics of where they were. And I did,
you know,
think
there's such a beauty to the decay and the change, you know, like that things do evolve and change over time. And that's another aspect that I love of your work. I mean, it's so present, and they could visit it on two different days and it would be different.
Definitely, definitely. And also, as we, I just think, you know, so many artists, you know, we try to sort of explore the human condition, and the human condition is that we adapt and are completely, you know, characterized by our cultures, by our environment, by our, in conditions that we're in. And I love the way that these sculptures aren't sort of, you know, static monoliths. You know, there are things that take on that shape and patina and adapt to their surroundings. And I think that's more truthful in a way.
So when choosing a site, how do you, I mean, there's obviously places you probably have already visited in diving, but when you do that, then also do you need permission from some of the places that you place stuff? But tell us about that process of choosing the site, and then if you have to get clearance from either a government or other entity.
Yes. So the one thing I've developed, this sculpture, you get calluses on your hands, but you basically get thick skin all over, because the bureaucratic side and the fundraising side and the logistical side are so such big elements. And choosing a site is you know, really critical part of it, making sure that you do get the permits. And the permits, you know, can take, you know, a month to get, or they can take 3 years to get. It's very different in each place. Obviously, the sea is incredibly volatile and huge forces and corrosive elements to it that you really have to factor in how they're anchored to the seafloor, how they're not going to be toppled by a big wave, how then obviously there'll be, you know, there's no negative impact to the existing ecosystem. So there's, yeah, a lot of factors. And being a you know, just making sculptures out of materials are very, very different. You know, traditionally, a lot of public sculpture is made from metal, whereas most of my works are made from inert materials, and that is, again, you know, a very different process.
Was that an already, what you're using, was that already in existence, or did you help formulate what you needed to have that happen?
Definitely adapted it, yeah, over the years. It's been sort of, yeah, 20 years of learning which materials.
Trial and error.
Starting off, it was very trial and error, you know, quite often because I had a very low budget and I was working with just materials that you know, that could be found on the island. But I learned quickly that, you know, the objects needed to be very heavy, that, you know, I couldn't include any sort of iron or metal elements in it, and that the surfaces had to be a certain pH to actually attract marine life.
That you mentioned funding, what kind of help has been available and for you to like facilitate this work, and how much of it comes to you via like commission, which then, you know, I'm assuming the funding is there, or you coming up with an idea and then having to locate the funding, and what is your staff like? And because it's like an amazing crew that has to make this all happen.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to it. I mean, firstly, yeah, the fundraising, it depends. I'd say probably 70% of the projects are public, government funded, either by various different grants. You know, in each country, there'll be a different, you know, fund that can be applied for. But other times, I've also done private commissions for hotels or individuals, or sometimes for charities that are trying to raise awareness of a certain campaign. It does differ greatly. And then again, the team of people involved, you know, is, you know, quite a process from the inception of making the initial designs and then making the molds, shipping the various components to arrive on site. I've changed a little bit. When I first started, I would move my studio to each location and then set up a studio on site, build up a sort of a local crew, and then work there. And that was really great. And I had some wonderful experiences. But my family have now threatened to leave me. Keep doing
it. They didn't want to travel along and set up camp in new places.
We did it for like, yeah, almost 12 years. But obviously with schools and that, it gets more complicated. Yeah.
So Jason, do you ever have to revisit some of the pieces? And I don't know, I know the evolution is to let things happen naturally, but repair and or modify or go back, or is, you just say whatever will happen once it's placed, it stays that way?
They're definitely intended to be naturally colonized. So, you know, we don't try to interfere too much with that process. I have done in the past, tried to sort of clean one side of a sculpture and leave another side. And it's counterproductive in the end. You know, it's just best to sort of leave nature to do its thing. I do go back a lot to try and monitor, you know, how they're colonized. For me, that is definitely the most beautiful part of the work, and seeing, you know,
the joy
in seeing that become a home. We do occasionally get some sort of damage, that if there's a big hurricane or there's some sand that's shifted, you know, haven't had to do it very often, but occasionally, especially because I'm often trialing new things. I always love to experiment and do, as all artists do, you know, sort of push yourself and look at something in a different way. So,
well, there's a natural evolution to an artistic practice.
There is, but yeah, some of my colleagues beat me over the head with it because it always causes headaches. Because we've incorporated lighting and sensors into some of the works. Some of them have been floating. Some of them are sort of 12 meters high, and then sort of done a range of different things, and you sort of learn something new on each. And you learn other things as well. You know, I'm not doing any more lighting because it's very complicated.
We'll be back in just a moment with our guest today on Art in the Air, Jason DeClaires Taylor. We'll hear more about his underwater sculpture journey. We'd like to thank you for listening to Art on the Air. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art on the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art on the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you. Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck, BRECH.com. We return with our guest today, Jason DeClaires Taylor, on Art on the Air, Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So, Jason, I ask about a particular sculpture or sculptures in Rising Waters. How does that collaboration work? Now, it seems so personal. Was that you coming up with this concept and then locating how it was going to get done, or was that one brought to you?
Definitely. I mean, no, that was one that, it was quite personal for me. And, working for public entities with public money, you know, there's certainly a responsibility to, you know, the client has a lot of input in what works, you know, they want to depict. Whereas I'm sort of a kind of repressed activist. that wants to be quite critical about a lot of different industries and issues that are taking place. And that's very difficult for public artists to do that, because there's so many processes, you know, with funding and with permits and, working in a gallery setting, you're allowed a lot more freedom. And it's a little bit harder in public. But saying that, you know, I do seek projects that allow me the most creative freedom, for sure.
So was Rising Waters, was that a public commission, or was that you finding funding to do an idea that you had?
A bit of both. Yeah, it was a festival that had some kind of some sponsors, and then we had some privately sponsored. But I think I was a little bit, well, you could say, not so clear to some of the sponsors what the work was about. So it was a sort of, maybe it was a celebration of the London horses, or maybe it was a piece that was highly critical of the fossil fuel industry.
I know it's very deceptive at first because, you know, we all have feelings one way or another about horses, you know, and they're so large and present. And then when you really look at it, you know, you see the, like that initial is like, oh, wow. And then you see the meaning behind it when you really look at those horses' heads and the expression on the people's faces and what they're wearing and very powerful.
There's quite a few sort of concepts that I have lined up, you know, for the right moment and the right circumstances to come about.
You know, I noticed that probably an ancillary part of your work is photography. First of all, you know, there's, and then of course, underwater photography is a whole different thing. But tell us a little bit about your doing photography and then adapting that to the underwater environment, and especially to capture the wonderful, stunning images you have of your work.
Yes, quickly learned that, you know, a small proportion of people actually go and dive and see the works. So, you know, in order to really document what was happening and to reach a wide audience, I had to really improve the photographic side. And yeah, something I, you know, devote a lot of time to and a lot of resources and have, yeah, trialed many different techniques in how to do that. And even to the extent now, you know, when I create the sculptures themselves, I sometimes position them in the water for good photography, you know, so that they're facing the sun at a certain time, that the backdrop looks in a certain way.
There's that set designer in you.
Yes, maybe.
Just knowing it's there is enough for me. You know, like for me, the audience are the inhabitants, all the sea creatures that are, you know, partaking, enjoying it. I mean, it would be fabulous to see it, but I'm so glad that there's film and still photographs of it because, boy, it's just glorious.
Do you ever want to work on non-water sculptures, or do you still do that anyway? You say, okay, this one's not going to go under the sea or under water. Is there something you want to work on that's actually land-based?
Yes, yeah, I do. I suppose, again, this is the, you know, exploring, you always want to be trying new things, and I can totally see where, you know, many musicians get frustrated where people just want them to play the same songs. And so, no, definitely, I'm very interested in, you know, obviously how environments, you know, change the work. And so I, you know, been looking at creating works on ice shelves in Antarctica, doing works that, you know, float on the surface, more tidal installation. I think the tides are really interesting because you're sort of crossing in between those two worlds. So it's definitely.
I know it's magical. The tide work is magical. Mm. So without, you know, I'm not asking for trade secrets or anything, but what kind of technique or what do you think about when you're doing the sculpture, and how do you choose between whether you're going to do a physical casting or a scan of a casting? And then more particularly, like when you have clothing or jewelry, is that worn or is that a scanned piece,
So I've sort of come, you know, traditionally from a life casting background. So that was, most of my training was in full sort of plaster casts of people with alginate, and that's what I've done. You know, there's probably been, I think, 1,000 sculptures now which are life cast, and there's a certain beauty in that for sure. You know, you're getting hyper detail of every person's skin pores. All of their characteristics, you know,
their cuticles,
everything is set in stone. And then I also dress them with their own clothes and jewelry and objects that then get cast again in a silicon, so that it has again the details carried through to the cement stage. But saying that, obviously, scanning technology is dramatically changing the world of sculpture. And I have sort of invested in it a little bit in the last sort of 5 years, and it's you know, from an environmental point of view, it's very good because I don't waste any materials. I can make 100 very hyper detailed scans of people, and it fits on a little chip on my computer. And then I can also play with the scales a lot, so I can, all the live casts are obviously at live scale, whereas the scans I can also increase and morph and change.
Is the 16 foot tall one the tallest one, or have you gone taller than that?
I think that's the tallest sort of figurative piece. There's a building we made in Australia that was, I think that's about 30 feet tall. But it's a different structure.
Oh, you know, Siren, that's Australia, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So how much does the water rise with that one? Because I've seen it where, you know, the figure is completely present and part of the pedestal, you know, but does it come up further?
No, that one is definitely above the water, basically because it's full of electrics that changes colors, obviously, to the temperatures. That's one that's it's currently having a few repairs done on it because the conditions are so extreme with the Australian tropical sun and the sort of rain that the materials have been expanding at different rates because it's half stainless steel and half a glass acrylic. The two materials have been expanding and contracting at different rates, and so we've had to go back and modify it.
You know, a question I have is, all your work placed in saltwater seas, or have you worked in any freshwater lakes?
Yes, I've done some. I've done a lake in the UK. Been working in some fjords in Norway, but yeah, most of them tend to be there in seawater.
The lake, your controversial piece.
No.
Oh, okay.
Definitely work.
And is there a difference in the environment? Obviously, as saltwater is a harsher environment in many ways. I know shipwrecks that are in freshwater lakes here in the Great Lakes in the Midwest are actually remarkably well preserved because you don't have some of the. But I mean, how does that affect your work?
Not in a great deal because they're pretty resilient. As I said, I don't use metals that oxidize at all. And actually being underwater, the worst is when you've got a high concentration of oxygen and salt. So at the water surface is when it's really corrosive. Underwater, it actually gets less. And then if you have objects that go into the sediment, that's why you get these ships that are so well preserved, where they're encased in silt and mud, you know, where the oxygen can't degrade them. It's not so much the actual materials degrading, it's more just the force of the sea sort of moving things around. People underestimate, you know, there's, you know, I've seen a 3,000 ton ship that gets lifted off the seabed and then lifted and then twisted like a cracker and then moved further down the seabed. So, you really can't. Not a price on it, but you can't undervalue how strong the sea is.
Well, and also it seems, and I want to say probably, I don't know, within the last 20 years, the brutality of like the natural forces or disasters, you know, the destruction is just so extreme. So does the way you construct take, you know, that into like what kind of factor does that hold with how you attach things? Because, you know, like I'm just thinking of tsunamis or, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. Again, the designs, you know, are really, you know, the sort of engineering comes in right at the beginning on, you know, you can't have flat surfaces because they cause too much resistance to wave energy. So, you've always got to make things that are porous that allow currents to pass through. You have to have very low center of gravity, so you've got almost like a pyramid shape to begin with. To the weight's low. connections.
Yeah, because even the flow in between the, you know, the figures, I mean, it just all seems very, you know, of course, deliberately placed, but also in accordance with the natural, you know, waves or, you know, not that they're predictable, but.
But it also changes. So sometimes, you know, obviously as they get colonized even further, they get heavier and more top heavy as well.
Oh, yeah. So,
it also changes over time. And it's the higher you are in the water column, the better the nutrients are generally. And the more organisms that you get that filter the water for nutrients start growing, which is really great. And they're really beautiful. But they also add a lot of weight and resistance. So, sometimes it could be their own sort of downfall, them growing too much.
Take a quick break here. This is Jason DeClaire Taylor, underwater sculptor, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So, Jason, is there a giant dream for future works or projects? And I'm not necessarily referencing like the size of something, even though I just talked about the 16 foot. I'm just talking about hopes and dreams that you want to share.
Definitely. No, definitely. I mean, you know, I've just turned 50 this year. So, you know, you always start to, and it's not, you know, I do think there's going to be a limit on how long I can dive and deal with bureaucracy for. It's very different from sort of recoiling into a studio and producing smaller work. So I do sort of think, you know, there's, you know, I've got a good 10, maybe 15 years left of doing this, and so that I should really focus on you know, what I want to achieve. And I am very keen on sort of wanting to make this kind of structure underwater that is a sort of sacred space, almost like a sort of a cathedral, obviously, where, you know, people worship their religion. But I wanted to create a sort of sacred space where people worship nature, and it becomes this sort of huge building that slowly sort of colonized and lets light penetrate through the ceiling and lets you sort of explore all the wonderful things that happen underwater in terms of shapes and sounds and light and wildlife, you know, and create this one experience that people can really sort of.
Well, I've seen your maquettes, you know, and the different sculptures that you make. Is that something that's ongoing during all of this as well? Are you making those, and are they available for the public to purchase? Or, you know, and I've also, you know, you post occasional pictures of paintings that you've done. So you're involved in a lot of different artistic expressions, but those sculptures are, those maquettes are gorgeous.
Yes, it's part of, you know, again, you know, part of the sort of dissemination of the works is trying to have land exhibitions and, you know, letting people sort of get a little piece of what happens underwater. And so I do a new technique in the studio where I put works in a copper solution and then activate it with electricity, and the electricity causes the copper to form coralline structures, and then so the works get disfigured by these copper crystals. And it's a sort of way of emulating how corals form their skeletons by drawing calcium out of the water. But in the studio, we're drawing copper out of the water, and obviously nothing organic or living is getting sort of harmed in that process. We do try to sort of emulate what happens.
Does anyone in your family dive with you, not necessarily to work, or maybe they do work, but has that become kind of a family thing that you do scuba together?
Yes. My daughter has just learned, and she's only 12 now. She absolutely loves it and is dying to get involved, but she's still a little bit too young to be there for the sort of, you know, the installation side. But I can definitely see her helping me with the photography and the sort of documentation bit.
What depth do you usually put your work at? I mean, and that's, I mean, obviously the deeper you go, the tougher it is to work, but you know, what depths are generally your work at?
It ranges, but I'd say we're in feet, so probably like 30 feet to about 15 feet. Pretty shallow most of the time. It's a little bit of a sort of catch 22 because the deeper you are, the more secure the works are, and the better they anchor to the seafloor. And the higher you go, the better the colonization is. But the wave energy is much higher in that first sort of 15 feet of water. So, but of course, they're obviously much more accessible. And when you open the works up for snorkelers, there's a, you know, really big audience of people now that love snorkeling. So I do try and go shallower.
15 feet dive snorkeling is a lot easier than a 30 feet dive. So
definitely.
It's wonderful because it does relieve the burden of the, you know, the reefs, you know, to have this other beautiful thing to take a look at. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Do you have any plans for work coming up, you know, that you're citing, you're already working on the work like in a studio, but you're planning coming up in the next year or so that you've already cited out and have ideas for?
Well, you've caught me at a good moment, actually, because I'm just about to fly off to install a big installation, which is in Karaku. And I've just made a fleet of 30 boats, which all go underwater, all made to look like they're paper origami. And they're all based on local school children from this island. And it was all about the sort of fragility of climate change and migration and the sort of uncertain future that some of these children face. Mm-hmm. And it's even more sort of poignant at the moment because I was meant to install it earlier in the year in June, but just before I was about to install it, a massive hurricane came in, Hurricane Beryl, and destroyed 90% of the buildings on the island. All of the children that I cast are now completely homeless.
It's devastating.
And as you can see, you know, there's the hurricanes are increasing in frequency this year across the Atlantic and Caribbean and you know, southern states in America. But now that I'm able to return and actually install this piece, and I'm looking forward to sort of going back. And they've been quite fortunate. There's been a lot of aid that's been donated and a lot of reconstructions taken place, and the community are now back on their feet, and they're trying to get tourists to now go back to the island and you know, aid with the sort of economic development and bring some of their jobs back. That's exciting times.
So those are out of like a marine grade stainless steel. How will you know, what is going to be the genesis of that underwater?
Yeah, so it's a special 316 marine grade stainless steel, and that is very stable underwater. It doesn't corrode, and lasts for a very long time. And then it's combined, you know, it has the large sort of concrete foundations as well to keep it in place.
Something I like to ask our artists, is there something you want to do completely different in your life, not even in art, that you haven't done that you'd like to do?
I don't know. I sort of feel the opposite. I kind of sometimes think I've done too much in too short a space of time.
It's time to write a book.
maybe. I feel like I sort of lived about five lives.
Yeah, you have stories.
Yes, yeah, a lot of stories for sure. Something I've still yet to do. I don't know. I'm a little bit obsessed about Antarctica at the moment. Really. Very keen on sort of carving ice and making floating works. Again, I suppose that's another kind of, going back to the artwork. Something unrelated? I'm not quite sure.
That's something to ponder.
We planted the seed of something. You say, okay, what do I want to do with the rest of my life in act two or act three of your life and everything. Well, we're about ready to wrap up here in about a minute or a minute and a half. So how can people find your work? And I know there are documentaries like BBC and things like that. Tell us a little bit about how people can find your work. And if they want to actually visit locales, you know, how they can find that out.
I'm sure to definitely head to my website, which is easy to remember. It's just underwatersculpture.com. And from there, you know, there's a list of all the different destinations around the world. And you can obviously see all the works on the site, but I'd really recommend that, you know, nothing beats the experience going and seeing the marine life, the conditions, the light, the entity in itself.
Is it easy to find the ones that are snorkel as opposed to scuba dive worthy?
Yeah, all of the destinations are linked with depths and different conditions. Most of them, there's a lot in the Caribbean, and all of those tend to be very shallow works that people on all abilities can access.
Sounds great. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art of the Air, sharing your art journey, sharing the very unique work that you do. It's a fantastic underwater sculpture that you can visit at the website underwatersculpture.com. James DeClaire Taylor, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing what a remarkable story that you have.
Yes, thank you. It's just been thrilling for me.
No problem. No, thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.